for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. It's a new day for natural gas companies. New drilling techniques make it possible to extract vast quantities of once totally inaccessible deposits of natural gas, something experts say could be a real game changer in meeting U.S. energy demands. But there are some environmental concerns. Joining us to talk about the U.S. natural gas industry and its future, Tom Gelton, correspondent for NPR. Terry Engelder, he's professor of geosciences at Penn State University, joining us by phone from Salt Lake. Chuck Stanley, he's chief operating officer at Questar Corporation. That's a natural gas-focused energy company. I'll look forward to hearing your questions and comments. Join us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning, Diane. Great to see you.
Good morning, Diane.
Good morning, Diane. Thanks for having me.
You are most welcome. Tom Gelton, I'm going to start with you. I know you're the lead correspondent on this three-part series that NPR is doing this week on natural gas. What was the impetus for you?
Well, Diane, we've been looking at expanding our energy coverage. Energy security, energy independence, and the geopolitics of energy are obviously huge issues, and we're looking to do more on this. I started sort of venturing into this area a few months ago, and one of the first things I heard is that you really need to pay attention to natural gas. And it actually came as a bit of a surprise. I hadn't, you know, natural gas wasn't seen, I think, generally as a really booming energy source. It came as a bit of a surprise to us at NPR. And if it's a surprise to us as a news organization, I'm sure it's a surprise to a lot of people. And digging into it, I did come to the conclusion that this is really quite a dramatic new development that really could alter the U.S. energy picture.
Chuck Stanley, how have the estimates for U.S. natural gas reserves been revised as a result of new drilling techniques?
Well, Diane, the biggest change that's occurred in the energy industry's perspective on natural gas supplies has been a result of discovery of new technologies or invention of new technologies for getting gas out of shales. We've known about gas locked in shales since the beginning of the natural gas industry over 150 years ago, but we could not figure out how to economically extract the large volumes of gas that's trapped in this very tight, very difficult to produce rock. Several technologies, horizontal drilling and stimulation techniques to break the rock and allow the gas to flow to the wellbore, have totally changed the game and resulted in a huge increase in the estimate of recoverable gas supplies in this country.
Help me to understand what you mean by horizontal drilling.
Well, Diane, a few years ago, we were only able to drill wells vertically into the earth. We would drill it to depths of several miles, 2 or 3 miles into the subsurface, and target individual pockets or accumulations of gas. We would then perforate the steel casing in the well and produce the individual accumulation or pocket of gas in the subsurface. Directional drilling technology, the ability to drill down several miles, 1 or 2 miles below the surface, turn the well bore and then drill horizontally for several miles, 1 or 2 miles in a horizontal plane, allows us to access the once inaccessible shale gas, which is trapped in these layers that extend over miles in the subsurface.
Chuck Stanley, he's chief operating officer of Questar Corporation. That's a natural gas-focused energy company. And turning to you, Terry Engelder, as you look at this process, what do you see as the potential? from these new drilling processes and the realization that there's a lot down there?
Well, Diane, I think the quickest way of expressing this is to point out that energy is available in the form of both petroleum and natural gas in the United States. In terms of petroleum reserves, the United States has about 21 billion barrels. If we look at just one of the gas shale plays, which is the largest one, the Marcellus of Pennsylvania and three or four other eastern states, and take the amount of natural gas available there and convert it to barrels of oil, the number is about 80 billion barrels. In other words, four times the amount of energy is available in that one play alone relative to the total amount of petroleum reserves that America has.
Help me to understand this Marcellus region in Pennsylvania.
Yes, one of the things that Chuck could have added to his talk about horizontal drilling is this new gas shale play is a play called an unconventional play, where the gas forms in a bed that continuously underlies a very, very large area of Pennsylvania. And what that means is that exploration for this gas is a very low-risk, a relatively low-risk process, where you drill down in virtually almost two-thirds of the state of Pennsylvania, and you can hit a prospective Marcellus gas play, drill down and then horizontally. And the important part of this horizontal drilling technique is that the operators need to clean out as best they can the entire layer, which is there in county after county after county continuously.
But what does that do to the ground surface?
It doesn't affect the ground surface appreciably, which means that the withdrawal of petroleum sometimes from a large porosity sandstone will cause subsidence. The gas shale has such a low porosity, which means it has a very small set of open spaces in it, that if the gas is removed from those open spaces, it's a compressible fluid anyway, then the rock will not collapse on itself and the ground surface will not change.
Terry Engolder, he's professor of geosciences at Penn State University. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. The question then, Tom, would be, once you've extracted this gas, you've got to turn it into liquid form, don't you, in order to make use of it?
No. I mean, the gas has to be compressed, but, you know, it's the same natural gas that comes out of your stove when you turn on the light. In other words, it is gaseous. Now, it does have to be, you know, there's a lot of things that, and Professor Engelder can explain this, but there are a lot of things that has to be done before it gets in that usable form. It comes out with a lot of oil mixed in with it and other things. These have to be separated. As I say, it has to be compressed so that it can move through a pipeline under pressure and so forth. But it remains in a gaseous state. I think now, I'm really getting out of my field here, but with liquid natural gas, LNG, is more for the it's turned into a liquid form more for the purposes of transport. For example, across the ocean, you will liquefy it in order to move it in big tankers across the ocean into LNG natural gas terminals. But getting gas out of the ground and moving it to somewhere else, you know, on the East Coast, it would be in a gaseous state all the time.
Tom Jelton, he's correspondent for NPR, covering energy and security issues. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Terry, you wanted to say something.
I wish to amplify this issue of the state in which a gas is transported. Internationally, when one puts it on a boat, one has to be very efficient about getting it all into a small space.
I would think so.
And that requires liquefaction. However, the buses of Washington, D.C. are compressed natural gas buses.
Right.
And in that case, the gas is still in a gaseous state. If America, for example, is going to take advantage of this very plentiful resource in terms of transportation, then what you'll find is a lot of vehicles, trucks, cars, and whatnot in the future will run on compressed natural gas, still in the gaseous state.
But now, Chuck Stanley, are you seeing kind of the equivalent of a gold rush going in there if this news about gas is available?
Well, Diane, certainly elected officials and administrators are beginning to appreciate the growing supply of natural gas that we've been able to identify in the shale gas plays that we've been describing to you. Let's put it in perspective. Professor Engelder mentioned the Marcellus Shale. Let's look at the entire national supply. Today, estimates from several institutions, including the Potential Gas Committee, which is associated with the Colorado School of Mines in Colorado, have recently posted estimates of natural gas supply in the United States of roughly 2,100 trillion cubic feet. Now, that's a very large number, and it's a hard number for us to parse. So let me put it into perspective. On an annual basis, the United States uses about 22 trillion cubic feet of gas. So close to a 100-year supply from that estimate. Some other estimates over 2,200 trillion cubic feet. So we have in this country today, as one of my colleagues has described it, a sea of natural gas that we are able to access and deliver.
Chuck Stanley, he's Chief Operating Officer of Questar Corporation. We're going to take just a short break. We'll be right back. Welcome back. We're talking about new reports that gas, natural gas, is plentiful in this country and that new drilling techniques are making it more available and could be quite an exciting new development on the energy front in this country. Joining us here in this studio is Tom Gelton. He's a correspondent for NPR covering energy and security issues. His latest book is Bacardi and the Long Fight for Cuba. On the line with us is Chuck Stanley, Chief Operating Officer of Questar Corporation. Also here in the studio, Terry Engelder. He's Professor of Geosciences at Pennsylvania State University. We've got lots of callers waiting, but Tom Gelton, I really want to know more about the impact on the land of this kind of exploration.
Well, Diane, a natural gas well generally will last somewhere around 30 or 40 years. And once it's drilled and operating, it's almost invisible. I mean, it's the wellhead is not, it's about half the size of this studio. I mean, it's about the size of a two-car garage. And the equipment that is left there is really unobtrusive. The issue is more at the very front end when the well is actually drilled. There's a lot of activity, a lot of trucks come in, and there's one other point that I'm sure listeners are going to want to talk about, and that's a very important issue. You mentioned horizontal drilling. The other key component of shale gas drilling is what's called hydraulic fracturing, because the gas, as Chuck Stanley said, the gas is embedded in the rock and it doesn't come out easily. So what you have to do is fracture the rock in order to get the gas to seep out. And the way that is done is by injecting water under very high pressure, water, sand, and some chemical mixture into the well bore. Now that is just done once at the beginning of the process, but it does involve a tremendous amount of water, and there's a lot of activity around. So that, the environmental issues are sort of around that process of hydraulic fracturing and the disruption of the land. But again, once the well is operating, you may drive right by it and not even be able to see it.
And Chuck Stanley, if you have permission from the landowner at the beginning of that process where the first drilling begins and the well is delineated, once you've begun the horizontal drilling, and as you said, you may go for miles, what about the property owner miles away who perhaps is not aware that this drilling is taking place underground?
Well, Diane, the property owner would certainly be aware, because normally the property owners also own the subsurface rights and therefore would enjoy the benefits of natural gas production from their property in the form of royalty payments as the gas is produced and sold. I'd like to point out that this horizontal drilling technique is really quite amazing, because instead of drilling, if we think about conventional vertical drilling from years ago, where in a square mile area we might drill 16 or 32 vertical wells, we may be able to extract the same quantity of gas from a shale layer by only drilling four or six wells, and obviously the surface disturbance as a result of that, even during the initial well construction phase, would be much less. So think of this as surgical removal of natural gas through a combination of horizontal drilling and fracture stimulation of the rock to create the cracks that allow the gas to escape into the wellbore.
All right, and Terry Engelder, Tom Jelton mentioned water and the necessity for water to do this kind of fracturing. How is the water supply beneath the ground affected by this kind of horizontal drilling?
Well, first of all, the water that's used for fracturing, at least in the state of Pennsylvania, it comes from surface waters. And I'm reminded that Pennsylvania is a state blessed with the largest number of stream miles outside of Alaska. So the availability of water is not a particular issue, at least in the northeastern United
but
States.
But what about affecting the quality of the water?
Now, what happens, the quality of the water, there are two issues. One is drinking water with the which comes from the near subsurface. And the operators, of course, put casing down and cement the wells to isolate the water used in the fracking process from local drinking water, so that this no longer is an issue. Now, what happens, though, is that frack water will then be produced. Not all of it comes back, but the water that does come back has a certain number of chemicals that are put in it for such things as reducing friction, because the water is pumped down very rapidly into the wells. There's a biocides to assure that bacteria doesn't clog the well bores, for example, and some of these chemicals come back and need to be treated before the water is released again. And so in the state of Pennsylvania, there's a very close working relationship between the operators, the Department of Environmental Protection, and the Water Basin Commissions, particularly the Susquehanna River Basin Commission, has been very proactive in assuring that everything is up to snuff when the water is returned.
You know, it's very interesting because my father-in-law, back in 1947, purchased a farm in Susquehanna County, way up in the Endless Mountains. We have a 65-foot deep water well. And one wonders if that kind of horizontal drilling were to take place, what are the assurances we're not alone in having those kinds of wells deep down? What are the assurances that they would not be affected, Terry?
Well, first of all, remember that the Marcellus is more than a mile down, 6,500 feet as opposed to 65 feet. So this is two orders of magnitude. And even the fracturing itself will affect a layer of rock that may be 200 feet thick. And so this water that's put down then permeates the Marcellus Shale in Pennsylvania and in Susquehanna County, for example, but it's still sitting beneath a layer that's at least 6,000 feet below drinking water supplies, for example, so that as long as the well that's drilled is properly cased, and what happens is a steel casing may be put through the groundwater, and customarily it might be driven as far as 500 feet down. This is cemented in place. Basically, it's sealed so that it assures that no water from the well bore as it's coming back up the well bore would seep around the edge of the casing and into the local water supply.
Tom.
Well, I investigated this because these are real concerns.
And
there are a lot of people that have very strong feelings about this and a lot of concerns. I became convinced, as Terry said, that where the horizontal drilling takes place is so far below the water table that it's really almost inconceivable that there'll be any effect on the water table itself. The issue has to do with a possible leakage from the well bore as it goes through the water table. It does go, obviously, through the water table, and any kind of leakage would be a risk. That's one. The second one is this water fracturing, this hydraulic fracturing process that takes place in the initial phase, all that water that, or as Terry said, not all of it, but most of that water that is blasted down into the wellbore has to then be removed when the process is finished, and it's got these chemicals in it. So then the second issue is that water disposed of properly, or is there the danger of a spillage of some kind, or inadequate treatment of the water, deficient treatment? Now, I think that what the people in the industry and supporters of natural gas say is that while these are serious issues, they are issues that can be dealt with through tight regulation and very close monitoring. I mean, it's clear that state environmental authorities do have a very important role to play here in the oversight of this process. But I don't think these issues, from what I can tell, I don't think these issues necessarily raise questions about the intrinsic safety of this well drilling procedure.
You know, there are an awful lot of people who might look back at promises made by coal production companies, especially in regard to mountaintop clearing and the kind of degradation to the land that took place and is still taking place in the mountains of West Virginia, for example, with mountaintop clearing. Are there true assurances that this kind of degradation would not affect the land, whether it's Pennsylvania or Arkansas or anywhere else in the country, Colorado, where these deposits of gas might take place?
Diane, probably the easiest way to answer that is to point out that hydraulic fracturing as an industry process has been going on for more than 50 years. It was developed around the Second World War. And if there were going to be true environmental problems associated with hydraulic fracturing, they would have emerged in the last 50 or 60 years. So there's a long practice.
Go ahead, Chuck.
Diane, let me add that there have been over 1 million wells that have been fracture stimulated since 1948 when the first stimulation was introduced. And there's been a lot of work and study done to look back at the practice to inception. Several studies, one conducted by the EPA, another more recent study conducted at the request of the U.S. Department of Energy by the Water Quality Council, who looked in detail at the impacts of hydraulic fracturing, not only on water quality issues, but water usage and the entire process. And the conclusion from those studies is that there's not been any documented instance of groundwater contamination by hydraulic fracture stimulation.
All right. We have a great many callers. I'm going to open the phones now, 800-433-8850. Let's go to Victoria, who's in Dimmock, Pennsylvania. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. I am living in the middle of this gas well drilling that you're talking about, and we have just had three guar contaminations in the last week into our wetlands and streams out here. We are living in a nightmare. I listened to you talk about proper, intrinsic, close monitoring. The gas company monitors their own activities. We have two guys out here we have 32 wells within walking distance from my house. The gas company does their own monitoring. And you need to check the news right now. Dimmock, Pennsylvania, we have three spills in 1 week, 6,000 to 8,000 gallons on one day. And yesterday, while they're cleaning that up, they had another spill. This is a nightmare. This is a nightmare. And as far as the safety, you have to go through the aquifer. And proper casing doesn't happen because who monitors it? The gas company. We have 17 people that do not drink their water. We buy water. And there are more because the gas company brings them water. But the gas company doesn't have to tell DEP who has contaminated water. There's no regulations for that. So I listen to you folks talk. We signed up with good intent, good faith, $25 an acre in 2005. We thought this was good for the country. They are destroying our homes. Our property is worthless. We buy water now. It's a living nightmare.
Thanks for calling, Victoria. Why don't you stay on the line at 27 before the hour? You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Tommy, in doing your research, I wonder if you've come across other folks like Victoria who are very concerned about what's happening.
Well, we had, my first story on this ran yesterday, and we got well over 100 comments from people that who do have concerns about possible contamination of water. I think, as Terry said, I mean, it's important to distinguish between anecdotal reports and documented evidence. There have been, as Chuck Stanley says, there have been studies about this done by the Groundwater Protection Council and by the EPA. But on the other hand, there is a lot of anecdotal information from people, and Dimmock, Pennsylvania seems to be one area where there have been a lot of problems for whatever reason.
Now, if you've got the gas companies themselves doing their own policing, doesn't that in and of itself create problems, Terry?
Well, obviously, they have a conflict of interest. That's why we hope that the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection and the Susquehanna River Basin Commission, two separate organizations, are keeping a close eye on this. I can't address Victoria's observations, the recent ones about the spills, but let me just say that natural gas diffuses upward from rocks in Pennsylvania and has been known to occur in water wells for as long as we've been drilling water wells. So the presence of natural gas, for example, in water wells is not necessarily linked to hydraulic fracturing and industry activity.
And joining us now is Theo Colburn. He's an environmental health analyst. She's environmental health analyst and founder of the Endocrine Disruption Exchange. Theo, good morning to you.
Good morning, Diane.
You've just heard from Victoria in Dimmock, Pennsylvania. What's your reaction to her concerns?
Well, I've been sitting in a position where since 2002, people knew that I was very interested in Western water quality. And consequently, what I just heard is something that I keep hearing over and over and over again. Numbers of spills, reports of contaminated wells, where people have been living and having comfortable lives and healthy lives for many years, things change. Yes, the engineering technology to get natural gas out of the ground has improved rapidly, and especially over the last 5 or 6 years, and a lot of that new technology was practiced on out here where I live in Colorado. But so have the number of chemicals that are being used. That's all part of the new technology. And so have the number of the companies that produce the products that contain the chemicals. That in itself has become a highly competitive industry. For example, in our database, we have been collecting what are called material safety data sheets. These are under OSHA law, the Occupational Safety Hazard Administration, products that come in large volumes and have dangerous chemicals in them must have on them what is called a material safety data sheet.
But now, Theo, what about the spills that Victoria is talking about?
Well, that was what I understand from the Dimmock situation is, yes, that was a spill. Basically, in order to fracture, large numbers of chemicals in liquid form are introduced into the fracturing.
All right.
And it was during that process, I believe, that a pipe broke.
Okay, so we're going to take just a short break. We'll come right back to you and more calls.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Global Nutritional Research, maker of Clotamin, a multivitamin designed for people on blood thinners, at clotamin.com. By the German Embassy, presenting Germany Info, a web publication with daily news from Germany, business and investment information, and suggestions for travel to Europe, on the web at germany.info. And by the Annie E. Casey Foundation, working to help vulnerable kids and families succeed, at aecf.org. This is NPR.
The Curse of Oil. A journalist describes the poverty, human suffering, and political instability that plague many of the world's oil-producing countries. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And we're back talking about the development of natural gas, new drilling techniques that make it far more accessible than previously. Here in the studio, Terry Engelder, he's professor of geosciences at Penn State University. Tom Gelton is a correspondent for NPR covering energy and security issues. He did his first report on gas development yesterday, another today. I gather there's a third coming tomorrow. And on the line with us is Chuck Stanley, Chief Operating Officer of Questar Corporation. That's a natural gas-focused energy company. And Theo Colborne, She's environmental health analyst and founder of the Endocrine Disruption Exchange. We've heard from Victoria in Demick, Pennsylvania, who has talked about the major spills that have gone on there in Demick. They can no longer drink their water. That is, of course, an anecdotal report. Tom Jelton, I know you've heard these kinds of reports, but that doesn't diminish the fact that there are a great many of these wells out there that apparently are safe.
Well, just to use Chuck Stanley's figure, 1 million wells dug in the last 60 years involving fracturing. And, you know, if you look at the whole tally of every reported anecdote of a problem compared with that statistic of a million wells, then it looks like a procedure that that is generally safe. I mean, as we were saying during the break, Diane, I mean, if you look at coal mining, if you look at oil production, we're talking here about fossil fuels, and getting fossil fuels out of the ground and to the consumer is not an easy process. It's one that's fraught with risks and dangers, and there are no easy solutions. Now, I think that, you know, the argument for natural gas is that compared to coal and compared to oil, it is cleaner, is clearly an abundant source of energy, and the safety issues, while significant, I think there are a lot who would say that the safety issues associated with natural gas extraction are fewer than they are with coal extraction, for example. So I think it is important to take, you know, a big look at this issue, to keep the whole issue in mind. You know, the United States is looking for energy independence, trying to reduce dependence on foreign oil imports, which affects our trade deficit, it affects our geopolitical relations.
Absolutely.
Concerned about climate change. You've got to factor all of these issues in along with safety.
All right, to Fort Worth, Texas. Jim, you're on the air.
Thank you, Diane. I had a question or wanted to raise a couple issues as background. I'm an attorney here, but served about a year on the City of Fort Worth task force that also had some major producers served on that task force to look at all of the issues, the positives and the negatives. And there's several issues that I wanted to raise just out of our experience here in Fort Worth and the Barnett Shale to get the comments on the panelists, because just listening to everyone, I think that the marketing is somewhat outrunning the facts on these. There's more than just anecdotal issues. The first is water usage. There's about 3 to 5 million gallons of water used for each well, which is an astonishing figure. The chemicals are probably the biggest issue. Those chemicals are extremely harmful, as Theo Coburn can comment on, but that is overlooked, and those are really essentially kept from the public as to what those are. One of the major issues we're dealing with here is disposal issues. All of that waste, is millions of gallons, are injected under high pressure back to lower strata in the earth. And we have actually had incidents of earthquakes showing up at the DFW airport and south of Fort Worth that are right now being looked at, but the preliminary indications are those are caused by this injected waste. Last are pipelines and compressors. The pipelines, we've had pipelines attempted to be laid in front yards of neighborhoods here in Fort Worth, and these residents, you know, they don't have any choice with that. They're just told this is a part of this new and wonderful technology with gas. Compressor stations, which have to be put in, are extremely large. I have to disagree with Mr. Jelton on the size of the well sites. I'm in downtown Fort Worth looking out a skyscraper at a well site that's probably 3 or 4 football fields in size that'll be there permanently with compressors that run 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So I realize that's a lot, but I concede the technology is fascinating. The comparison of gas as a fuel to coal is definitely a positive, but many, many calls I get from residents, Arkansas, Louisiana, and Texas, there are more than just anecdotal problems with this production.
Interesting. Terry.
There are issues with any type of industrial endeavor. and what we rely on very heavily, at least in the state of Pennsylvania, is the oversight of the regulators, Department of Environmental Protection. And in regard to the footprint of this industry, of course, there's the drilling pad itself, what's left over. Nevertheless, this gas has to be shipped to market, and it does require compression at some point. And so, at least in the state of Pennsylvania, where the production is rural, these large compressor stations are placed in places where the industrial noise, for example, from them doesn't affect the population. Jim is right. In the city of Fort Worth, this is a major problem, putting these things in where they're unobtrusive.
But this is a compressor station. It's not a wellhead. I was referring to the wellhead, which is where the, you know, the top
yes,
of the well. Compressor
I
station
understand.
Is a whole different thing.
Sure. We've got two different perspectives here. One from Katie, who says, I'm a landowner of a new natural gas well in the recently found Haynesville Shale in northwestern Louisiana. I've been so impressed with the natural gas companies involved. The pad is kept clean. We as landowners are kept well informed of developments, and the timber on the land has been preserved. My impression that, the impression that the Haynesville is one of the largest gas shales found in the world and the largest in the United States. Is this true, Terry?
There are three or four really significant gas fields, Marcellus, the Haynesville, the Barnett, of course, Woodford in Oklahoma, Fayetteville in Arkansas, and it will take a long time to fully evaluate these. Geologists I have discussions with, of course, will offer figures on which one is largest. I think that question is not as relevant as the fact that these gas fields combined offer such a wonderful opportunity for America to reevaluate its energy profile, where it gets its energy from, where it spends its money overseas versus in America. There are a number of things that really are game-changing as the result of this
natural
gas.
Here's another one from Laurie, who says, I live in Geneva, New York, where there is currently a massive amount of gas drilling going on. I allowed Chesapeake Natural Gas to buy a lease for my land ground rights. When they fractured the shale, my well was directly affected. My water was gray, had particles in it. If I had not fought them to have them put in my contract that the water would be potable, they would not have paid for a special filter to put on my water source into my house. And they only paid for that for a minimum number of months. Now I'm concerned about information coming out about the chemicals that may be contaminating my water. Tom.
Well, Dan, one of the big, you know, because this is a new, relatively new industry, or certainly a rapidly expanding industry, there are a lot of policy issues that have not really been worked out
right.
yet. And one of them is the content of the chemicals that are used in this hydraulic fracturing process. This is something I'm sure that Chuck Stanley has a thought on. There is a move in Congress to require natural gas companies to divulge the chemicals that they use as part of the hydraulic fracturing process. And that's one that obviously consumer advocates feel strongly about. This is, I'm sure that this woman in New York would like to know what chemicals were used in that fracturing process. I'd be curious. I think that there has been some resistance to this on the part of the natural gas companies.
You it's mean to that... disclose? Yes. Theo Colborne, do you have a comment?
I have a number of comments. First of all, we're avoiding discussion here about air pollution, which is a big problem, and the land pollution as well as water pollution. Just keep that in mind. These are not discussed. But back to the chemicals. Well, we were able to trace, believe it or not, of these 915 products, this is just in seven states, only one-third of those material safety data sheets, the thing that comes with the product, told us, basically reported, only the name and no identifiable chemical or percent composition, and only 5% of the products had information that provided full chemical composition and formulation. Now, also, when using the material safety data sheets, we found 596 chemicals in those products, but we were only able to specifically identify 340 or 61% of those chemicals using what are chemical abstract names where you can go back and look up the health effects. Now, our concern is, what do the first responders do? What happens to those people when they come to the accidents? What happens when there's an eruption near someone's home and people have to leave? What do we know about those chemicals? We had a situation in Colorado where a nurse almost died, and it was a year later when the company finally decided, they said they would send her the information of what was in the product that almost killed her. And interestingly enough, the material safety data sheet that accompanied that product the day she was injured did not match the product that was finally identified a year later.
All right, let's turn to Chuck Stanley, because it would seem there is a great deal of responsibility falling onto the gas company developers themselves. What are you doing in this regard, Chuck?
Well, Diane, first of all, let's keep in mind that about 99.5% of the fluid that's pumped in the ground is water and sand. We're talking about concentrations of chemicals, things like citric acid, which is a food additive. We're talking about guar gum, which is found in toothpaste and cosmetics and ice cream and other edible substances. Yes, some of these substances can have detrimental health effects if they're consumed in large quantities. But we have to keep in mind that they're being used in small quantities in large volumes of water and sand.
But let me ask you right there, Chuck, to what extent is the owner of the property notified from the beginning that these chemicals are in use?
That depends on the practice of the individual company. In the areas where we've been active, I can only speak to my company, the landowners are very well informed that we are going to fracture stimulate the wells, and that we are using water. We are using some chemicals. But let's go back to the disclosure issue, because I think that's really the topic here. The MSDs are material disclosures of the primary constituents of these fluids. They are required for transport of these fluids over the open road by the Department of Transportation, and they are a government-required disclosure. Where there have been instances or questions about composition, the individual companies that provide the fracturing service to us have been happy to provide the details on the composition to attending physicians, emergency response personnel, et cetera. But there is some degree of proprietary consideration here in the exact formulas that are being used by various service providers. We contract with third-party companies to provide the pumping services that fracture the wells, and each one has their own proprietary technology, and you can understand from a competitive position that they're not they're uncomfortable with full public disclosure. So what we're talking about as an industry is, how can we allow regulators and government officials to understand the exact composition without compromising competitive information?
So,
Chuck, I want to correct what Chuck said.
All right.
The material safety data sheet, all the companies get is a boilerplate form where you fill out the chemical characteristics. Will it cause a fire? Does it explode? Is it volatile? Is it not volatile? When it comes to the health effects, the companies basically have their own, they can put in what they want. Not one of those material safety data sheets goes back to OSHA for review. What goes on those material safety data sheets is left up to the product manufacturer, and the public needs to understand this. This is where the law needs to be changed, too.
All right.
OSHA needs help badly.
All right. And, Tom, do you see OSHA stepping up its work here? Do you see the EPA stepping in more heavily? Do you see state environmental regulations moving in to be more present as this kind of activity goes on.
All of this is happening, Diane. Keep in mind, you know, you're a landowner in Pennsylvania. Horizontal drilling and hydraulic fracturing began happening in Pennsylvania on a large-scale basis only within the last 2 years or even less than that. So it takes a while for these regulatory bodies and state legislatures and Congress to get up to speed.
To catch up.
Absolutely. That's where we are now. There's an awful lot of activity going on. There are bills pending in Congress pertaining to this disclosure issue. So, yeah, that it's really heating up.
Tom Jelton, he's correspondent for NPR, covering energy and security issues. You can hear more on this whole issue tomorrow morning on Morning Edition. Terry Engelder, he's professor of geosciences at Penn State University. Chuck Stanley of Questar Corporation and Theo Colborn, environmental health analyst and founder of the Endocrine Disruption Exchange. Thank you all so much.
Thank you, Diane.
Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.